I better start my stopwatch also. Let's see. Stopwatch. Do you use a talking watch or you use a Braille watch?
Braille, definitely.
Braille, definitely. Because you go to meetings and...
I don't want it talking during the meeting. That's true.
Yeah. Well, all right. Let's welcome to our Blind Like Me show a fellow that I believe is known of by more blind people than anyone else. His name is Jim Snowbarger. Sir, how are you?
Fine, sir. Nice to be with you.
That is good. And you're in Ottumwa, Iowa, I think. Is that right?
That's where I'm originally from. I live in central Iowa right now. Ottumwa is in southeastern Iowa, kind of a more rural area, and that's my beginnings.
That was where you were raised.
Mm-hmm.
And you were born with this blind thing, or what?
Yeah, pretty much. It was figured out maybe by the time I was a year old that I had some vision problems, and how much sight I had before that, I don't really know. I don't remember functioning visually except at a really kind of subtle level. I sort of vaguely remember images, but I don't think visually at all.
Do you have any concept of colors or any of that?
No. I know what they are, of course, physically, but they don't mean anything to me. I've always been interested in the importance of being blind from birth as opposed to going blind earlier, and the experts talk a lot about that and how it might affect your ability to conceive of things spatially.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always had really good spatial awareness. I can imagine three-dimensional things in my head very well, and I know what north and south mean, and I never had any problem like that at all. I navigate well, and so I don't know what that means, except that I'm almost born blind, and I certainly do have an awareness of that.
So the conventional thinking is that if you could see for a while, you'd be better off as far as spatial things?
Yeah. I think the idea is that you would have built the basic infrastructure in your brain because you were able to see things, and that people who are born blind didn't start that way, so they think of things differently. And the educators target that. You know, they talk about developing this concept in people, and that always baffled me because I always had it.
Yeah,
and I wonder about it a lot. Anyway, I functioned as a blind person for almost all my life.
I remember 16, 18 years ago, I was building wanted to build some speaker cabinets with my brother, and I got him in, or my brother-in-law. I got him involved because he had a saw at that time, and I didn't. And so I was telling him about these speaker cabinets, and he said, well, I can't see that. I don't know what you're talking about. You'll just have to tell me what to cut. And I thought, well, geez, you can see, and I can't, and here I got it, and, you know.
Well, I think part of that, though, is that a lot of sighted people don't function verbally. They can't take these little verbal bits and put it together and integrate that into a picture. I have that same problem around here with people at work. They have to draw pictures, and I have to guide them carefully through drawing the picture, and then once they see it, oh, yeah, now they get it. But to be fed verbally and then for them to mentally integrate that, that's hard for some people, and other people are more able. And these are all sighted people, so it varies even between from one sighted person to the next how well they can integrate those pieces.
Sure, it would. But basically, you've been without sight all your life.
Yeah.
And you said this was a more of a rural sort of a setting. Did they, were they, your parents, did they didn't farm or anything, did they? Or did
Yeah, they did.
Oh, they did?
Yep. And we lived on a farm till I was 9, I guess.
Really, with chickens and cows?
Yep. You bet.
Man.
And I was, of course, you know, I was not very helpful being such a little kid, but I did feed cattle and pick up the eggs, and you know, I'd dig around in the garden, probably cause more trouble than I was worth. But
you could go.
Yeah,
get
I was
the
always
eggs.
Out moving around and doing stuff.
You were good for going and getting the eggs and things
yeah.
like that.
My parents were really great. I think I was terribly fortunate because they didn't know anything about blindness. They had never even met a blind person, and yet they get a blind child.
Yeah.
And most parents will go ask the experts how to treat this special child. My parents didn't ask the experts. The experts barged in later on their own. Yeah. But my parents just took a real common sense, practical approach. You know, they weren't sophisticated people. They weren't educated. They were just ordinary, close to the land kind of folks. And they mm-hmm. just said, "We don't know anything about this. You're going to teach us." And they just pushed me in and said, go for it. They never told me to be realistic and to downsize my expectations. They never said, you're going to have to just realize you can't do that. They just said, go find out what you can do. You know, you figure out where the limits are. And even when I would whine sometimes and say, I don't think I can do that, they would just... No, they weren't very sympathetic. You know, they just said, go push, and
yeah.
you push those limits as far back as you can, and you'll figure out what they are, but we're not going to ever tell you that you can't do it or that you shouldn't expect to succeed. And that was a wonderful thing.
They made sense enough to know that they didn't know, so you didn't know, so let's just do whatever we can.
Yeah, and so we did a lot of things because we didn't know they couldn't be done.
Did you have siblings?
No, they were. I had three brothers, but they were much older than me.
Really?
And, yeah. So they were pretty much gone. There was one brother who was around. He was a teenager when I was a little kid, but we didn't have much to do with one another.
So basically, you were raised kind of as an only child.
Yeah. Right. In a neighborhood that that didn't even have many other kids. Well, there were a couple on a couple occasions, but most of the time I was alone. So I was out riding my bicycle and my tricycle and climbing trees and doing things by myself. Occasionally, yeah. my cousin would come and spend some time, and we would build things together. But my dad was a carpenter, so I had exposure to lumber construction and access to his spare parts. And, you know, so I was always building tree houses and ramps to ride my bicycle on. And
at an early age.
Yeah. And I was totally blind, so I'm going off the edge of the ramp.
Okay.
You know,
it's all right.
Hey, we're just having fun here.
Yeah.
So I just
yeah, and you were little, you were invincible, and you couldn't get hurt. I mean, you could fall 15 feet and not get hurt.
Right. You'd break an arm and not get hurt.
That's right. It wouldn't. But I've never had a broken bone.
I didn't until I was an adult.
Really?
But that wasn't a blindness thing. It could have happened to anybody.
So they raised you. They sent you when you turned six, and it was time to go to school. They sent you to the Iowa School for the Blind, the equivalent.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. Right? Yep. And that the experts came and told them that you know, this is the best thing, and we can teach them so much more than you can. And so we did that thing, and yeah, and it was not a bad situation. That at that school, they probably didn't ask as much out of us as they should have, but they were pretty good. And I would say compared to other schools, they were fairly demanding. They didn't make a lot of excuses for us.
Yeah, your experience, I think we've talked about this a little before, your experience at blind school experience was good, wasn't it? You enjoyed
it. Yeah, it was very painful, of course, to leave home. That was horrible. Sure. That really, 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 really upset me a lot.
Whoa, I never got over it. I spent 12 years never being angry about it. I never got over it.
Yeah. I know, I wasn't so much angry as just plain hurt. I just felt devastated.
As like I've said many times, I was blind, and now they were punishing me because I was blind.
Yeah, I
took me away from my parents.
Yeah.
I did too. I think, how could you not at 6 years old?
Yeah.
But think how I've often looked back and thought, think how your mother felt. She must have been horribly hard on her.
Yeah, it was.
Send her little blind child away to the blind school. Now, did your father do carpenter work for other people or just around his?
No, that was his. That was his line of business.
Was it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Besides farming, that was his line of business.
Yeah, he got into that more when farming wasn't lucrative. We were renters, So, you know, somebody else was always taking half the profits, and we just never really got up to the critical mass where we owned our own stuff and could make money. So his dad had a building construction business, so he went to work to work for his dad. So we moved to town and made the big transition, the big cultural transition from the rural life to this city of 30,000 people. And really, there was a cultural transition.
Sure it was.
They thought they were pretty sophisticated there in town.
Yeah. What is the old song about? A washing machine and a Chevrolet. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And they had a Frigidaire and all that stuff. You
and
know?
That's and almost what it was. That's almost the way it was. It were, you know, people would live in, you know, the Iceman cometh around to bring ice, and people moved to the city and bought them a real refrigerator. You know?
Yeah. Big time stuff, and they used different words. You know, yeah. The lower part of a chicken leg that you eat, they called it a drumstick. They were legs to us, but they were drumsticks.
Chicken legs.
Yeah.
But they were drumsticks.
Right.
Yeah, that's the old song said, all I ever got was the north end of a chicken flying south.
Oh, well, sometimes that's the best part.
So you, Iowa School for the Blind started in first grade, start teaching you Braille. And you excelled at that, I would guess.
You know, I was not as good a Braille reader as some, and I always had to kind of struggle. Honestly, I was kind of a halting reader, and that always bothered me. And I never really read as much Braille as some kids did, because it just took a lot of energy. And I still feel that way. You know, when I did my radio shows, I read Braille, and it sounded pretty good, but it took a lot of energy to do that, and I couldn't sit down and read a novel in Braille. It's just not worth the effort.
Have you ever done it?
Well, they were short ones in school when we had to do book reports, but I was always looking for that magic two words on the last page.
I was hoping you wouldn't say no, because I think I'm the only blind. I've never read a Braille book in my life. Never, never, never. But
it is a lot of work. And that's, I think it takes more mechanical energy. You got to move your hands, and you got friction on the page, and, you know, using your arms a lot. And
you know people, and so do I, who prefer it, who love it.
Yeah.
You know, who just...
They do. And I also think that Braille literacy is really a critical thing. I wouldn't be without it. I use it all the time. I have Braille displays on my computer. I read Braille all of the time, but I don't like to read large volumes of it. If I'm going to read a novel for enjoyment, then I want to listen to it. But if I want to look at detailed information, as I do in my computer programming work, for example, I want to stare at it and think about it. I want to have it in Braille so I can kind of go back and forth and contemplate it. Speech in that kind of detailed environment is really hard to deal with, because, again, you have to take little pieces of information, put them in your brain, and then integrate that together to get meaning out of it. And then if you've forgotten something, as I do at my age, I'm starting to forget more things, and I imagine, Phil, being as old as you are, you forget even more.
Yes, you do.
You have to go back and listen to it again. Well, with Braille, it's easier to refresh that.
To just feel it with your hands and think about it at the same time. I guess it would be.
Yeah.
I only use Braille for, I use it for labeling things, and that's about as far as I get.
Yeah, that's good too.
But
it's a wonderful thing, and I hope we maintain it. I think it's, you know, I'll tell you another thing that's kind of interesting is that I've noticed a lot of young blind people cannot spell, and their punctuation and spelling in email is atrocious.
Yeah.
And I think it's in part due to the fact that they listen to more things than do they read them with Braille. So you're not even aware of the spelling. And when you look at it in Braille, it's obvious, although contractions in grade 2 Braille also mislead you there. But people who are good Braille readers have a much better grasp of that.
Of punctuation spelling. And spelling.
Yeah,
I know when I finally decided to become computer literate, my spelling is still not good, but it's a whole lot better than it was 5 years ago, because I do email and write things all the time.
Well, if you're writing a resume or otherwise trying to get a job, I think if you misspell and and punctuate things badly, it doesn't help you either.
My wife talks about that all the time. Kids that come in that have college degrees that are applying for a law clerk's job at her office that can't spell.
That's pathetic. It's just amazing. It's embarrassing, and people should be more aware of it and try to correct that. It can be corrected.
All right, let's take a little short break, and we'll get you into high school and talk about your developing, because at some point in time you found the magic music, since you have been involved at different times in music. So let's get into that in just a minute. More of Blind Like Me back in just a second.
Hi, my name's Donna, and for the past 5 years, I've lived up here in the cold country, Rochester, Minnesota. I'd love to move
Love
to a warmer
is
place,
blind.
But, you know,
the audio magazine
you know
for singles.
Anyway, I'm around 32 years old, give or take a couple of years, and never been married. Oh, come close once or twice, but things just didn't work out.
If you'd like more information about this exciting new magazine, phone toll-free 1-877-222-0679. That's 1-877-222-0679. Or you can receive the same information as an email. Our address is loveisblind, all one word, at blindlikeme.com. That's loveisblind at blindlikeme.com. Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
Are you a public radio nut? Well, then you should take a look at publicradiofan.com. This is a great website for anyone who's interested in public radio programs such as All Things Considered or Prairie Home Companion or many of the other hundreds of programs offered on public radio throughout the country and throughout the world. You can do such things on the site as check and see what programs are on at the time that you log on to the site, or you can check and see when your favorite programs are on. Let's say, for example, that you know you're going to miss Prairie Home Companion on Saturday night, but you want to try to find out when else it's going to be on. You can look that up. And there are even audio links where you can go and set it up so that you can actually listen to the particular program that you want. So if you want to hear Prairie Home Companion, say, 3 times in 1 weekend, you can set it up to do that. It also has links to a lot of international public radio sites from different shortwave radio services all around the world that you can also listen to. The web address is http://www.publicradiofan.com. I would give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And for Blind Sites, this is Tim Cummings saying keep on websiting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sites.
Second portion of our show. I'm Phil Parr, along with Jim Snowbarger, and we have him in grade school learning Braille, the Iowa School for the Blind. You liked it there? You did well there. They had a big music department, correct?
Yeah, but they didn't appreciate my sense of music at all.
Really?
They just thought it was totally. I was into country music in those days. I wanted to sound like Buck Owens. I wanted to play guitar like he did, or like Roy Clark, you know. And the people in the music departments, they all believe in Mozart and Chopin and all that. And Buck Owens is completely illegitimate. There's no reason to ever. Never mind that he made more money than they had.
Put together. Yeah. And so this was in the early 60s when Buck Owens got hot. Because there was a couple of years there when everything he did was a hit song.
Yeah, it was gold. And so I wanted to do that. And I learned guitar from a friend of mine. He taught me everything that he knew, and then I went on to just learn myself from there. And that was what I pursued. And we had our own little group, you know, two guitars and drums and bass.
Little country group?
We did country, and we also did some light pop and Tijuana Brass and, you know, stuff like that.
Creedence Clearwater Revival, that stuff, maybe, or not?
No, we were a little more sophisticated than that.
Really?
Yeah, we had a nice sense of melody about us. We weren't, you know, Creedence is kind of basic.
Well, yeah,
and we were a little one cut above that. And that there's anything wrong with Creedence, really. It's just that that's not where we were coming from.
But Buck Owens is pretty basic, too. That's, you know.
Yeah, well, that's where we started. But when we got into Tijuana Brass and Ed Ames and some of that stuff, we learned a few more chords.
Yeah, you wanted to do those big diminished and augmented and things.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, we didn't know what they were called, but wanted to do them anyway. And Classics 4, that was another good one. They used a lot of complex chords in their pop music, and we liked that.
Uh-huh.
But we were not at all considered legitimate by the music department, and you know, they would. We had some other groups that played Dixie and some of those other things, and those guys got engagements, but we didn't get any. We had to go get our own engagements, and sometimes we'd even get told by the administration we couldn't do it. They just wanted to trouble us.
But they didn't. That you didn't take piano lessons at an early age, like most of us did.
Well, I started, but I didn't do very good.
I didn't either, but I made a living playing music. That's really funny.
I quit. So, and I wish I hadn't quit. I really think I'd be more accomplished. I wish I'd stuck with it. But
you got to think, with a guitar, you have to fret the note and then pick the note. With a piano, all you have to do is push down a key and it'll make the note for you.
Yeah.
It would be the best of instruments. I wish I had pursued piano. But
It is nice, and also you can make chords that you can't do on a guitar.
Sure.
And just because of the way the fretting works. But I got into keyboard later to some degree. But again, I was self-taught, and I think keyboard is a complicated enough skill that it's like language. If you learn it when you're little, it becomes a part of your brain, and you can automatically do things that later in life, if you try to learn that, you have to really think about it, and so it's hard to do. You're just way behind the curve if you start later in life.
I think that's true. I didn't learn to play. I don't play much guitar, but I didn't learn to play until I was in my mid-20s and realized, hell, everybody else can play a little guitar. Why can't I? So I bought one and taught myself to play it, which wasn't any big deal. I was already playing music for a living. I was playing bass. I learned to play guitar, but I'm not good, and I never will be, because I started too late.
Yeah, that's the deal. So I was kind of a rebel, and I didn't do what I should have done, and I'd be better off if I had. But you do what you do. You know, life is what happens.
Yeah, that's really right. But you fooled around with music, and you got to, did your interest in radio, I guess, began at an early age?
Yeah, actually, that was, I believed in two things. My religion was music and broadcasting.
Yeah.
And then electronics was an interest, and it supported those two. Electronics that didn't deal with broadcasting or music in some way, I was less interested in. But that's what really kept me busy when I was a kid. When I would hang out in the basement in the summertime by myself, I was pursuing electronics for the sake of doing this broadcasting thing and maybe making music with it. And and I was broadcasting on the radio. I had figured out how to transmit around the neighborhood when I was in late grade school. So I was playing records and.
So you'd figured out how to transmit. You were some way or another using an AM radio as a transmitter?
Yeah. Yeah, they have a little oscillator in them, you know, and I got in, after getting practically electrocuted three or four times, I figured out
how to do it, but I never could figure out how to get audio to it.
Well, that's what breakthrough I stumbled upon, and after I went to college and studied engineering, I figured out what I had done.
Uh-huh.
But at the time I discovered it, I just fell into it.
So this was AM, and you found an unused frequency, and you were playing music around. You had a little illegal radio station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is at age 12 or 14?
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I first stumbled on it when I was that summer when I was 9. It was like 1962, and I remember how exciting that was. Man, that was just unbelievable. And of course, I got more sophisticated as time went on. But that station would just go around the house, and it really was AM. Later, what I ended up doing is really FM on the AM band, for those of you who know about what that means. It's not as good.
Frequency modulation on the AM band?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crude, but it had some interesting characteristics, too.
I don't know how you do that on the AM band. I'm completely lost.
The deal is when you modulate the signal, you can either raise and lower the amplitude, the strength of the signal, to follow the audio waveform, or you can vary the frequency. And I was accidentally varying the frequency, and I didn't mean to do that. So, in order to make sense of that with an AM radio, what you have to do is tune off to the side of the carrier. If you tune right in the middle, it sounds distorted, but if you tune off to the edges, it sounds good. So,
and you figured all that out at you were on the, you had a radio station by the summer you were 10, you were broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
Man,
I just, see, the thing, it wasn't that I was brilliant, it's that I was dedicated. I just kept working on it. And that's the thing. I mean, you can achieve a lot in life if you just focus. And I focused like a laser beam. I cared about little else.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's like really bizarre that somebody would be like that. But that's what I was like. I was just obsessed. And other kids would come around, you know, and they'd want to play baseball or something. I didn't care about that.
Now,
I wanted to go play radio, and they didn't care about that.
You had a little turntable set up,
mm-hmm.
and had a little 45, probably a little RCA changer.
Yeah, yep.
I'd love to have one of those again.
That would be neat to see one.
I've probably got 1,000 45s still, and I would love to have a little RCA. I guess if a guy really wanted one, you could probably look on eBay and find one.
Yeah,
really,
I imagine.
If that's what one really wanted to do.
Right.
So were you playing record music, or did you play any live music on the radio?
Yeah, it was all records. I didn't do any live stuff on the air. Oh, maybe once, twice. I can't say it never happened, but it was mostly playing records because they sounded so much better than I did.
All right, now, but at some time in your high school years, you actually had a little record that they played on the stations in your around your area, didn't you?
That happened in college.
Well, that was in college.
Like 1973, we made it was 74 maybe. And I just coughed up some of my own SSI money, I guess. And I had this song that I'd written. I'd been starting to write probably in high school with a guitar, and I got one that I thought was pretty good. I thought it had a lot of harmony in it, and I just really wanted to make a 45, and I thought that was a pretty big deal that I took $600 and went into a studio and made it.
It was a big deal.
Yeah, it was. It was a big deal to me, and we actually got it played on some of the stations here in Iowa. And I have several hundred copies left if you like one.
Well, I was listening to your do you still do Saturday? Do you still do that Saturday show or not? Or you quit that?
No.
You quit that too?
Yeah.
Well, back when you did it, you played that your little record I heard it. So that's how
on my FTP site. People can have it now.
You can.
I have if you go to my website, which is snowmanradio.com, there's all the clues to how to get to my FTP site and some of that stuff's on there.
All right, so you graduated high school from the Iowa School for the Blind. What did you think? Had you decided then you were going to be a musician or a radio man, or what were you going to do?
Well, actually, I didn't graduate from there because in 10th grade I got really restless and decided that I needed to conquer public school before I took on college. And so I spent the last 2 years in public school. And while that was culturally and emotionally very difficult, it worked out well scholastically. And I'd really gotten into the electronics thing, and my dad said, you know, broadcasting is just a bunch of charlatans, and most of those people get paid less than I do. So you got to go, you got to be shooting higher than that.
Yeah, I wonder how he, that's true, absolutely true, but I wonder how he knew that.
Oh, he's a very practical guy. And he looked at the broadcasting people in our community and saw what kind of people they were. They were changing jobs every couple of years, and they, you know, they just kind of drifters, really, a lot of them. And, you know, there are some people in broadcasting that make a lot of money. And, of course, it's sort of like sports. The high-profile people that you know about, they make big money. So you look at that and say, well, gee, there's an example. People make big money, but most people don't. Most people flounder and lose jobs and get fired all the time. And well, you got blindness involved in the whole topic of, can I get a job and can I get my next job? It's always an issue. So he was looking and saying, you know, get something that's stable and something that will provide a good income for you and where you can stay there. It was good advice. And I didn't really want it. I wanted to do the fun stuff. And sure. I just about jumped careers a couple of times. But the electrical engineering thing was just a better choice long term. And that's what I've done. I've stayed with that. So I went to college to study electrical engineering and did it in 4 years. And didn't get a job in that field right away, but eventually did. And I've been fortunate enough to be employed all along.
Well, that was still a fairly bold thing to do at the time you did it. There weren't too many blind people who had degrees in electrical engineering.
No. There were a couple of noteworthies that were driven by Jernigan and Company. Actually, Curtis Willoughby and Lloyd Rasmussen were at the school that I attended, the Iowa School, and they had already blazed a trail. So I didn't have to be the first guy. But it was the third, I guess. And I remember that going to... I'd worked in rehab right after college and a little bit in broadcasting because I wasn't getting offers. I was just writing letters of application and getting thank you but no thank you letters.
This was after college, after you had the degree.
Yeah.
Yeah, you say you did a little broadcasting then? Worked in,
Yeah.
Worked weekends for somebody or what?
No, I was working midday.
Really?
Yeah, weekdays.
The midday disc jockey.
Yeah. That's when I found out that broadcasting was a lot less fun than I thought. And really, you know, just playing music and reading commercials is pretty dull. If you're going to do it, broadcasting as a personality is a lot more fun. And that maybe would have been a completely different take on life. I've often wondered if you could back up and redo things, what that would have been like.
To have done something other than time and temperature.
Yeah.
And to have actually tried to be a personality.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't know why, but there was something magic about a good time and temp jock to me at one time. That's what all I really wanted to do was be able to. I don't know what I wanted to do, but I wanted to be on the radio, and I wanted to be the best time and temp jock, because there were good ones and bad ones, as you well know. And
you bet.
I wanted to be a good, I like personalities on the radio, but I never thought that I would be able to be one. And now I'm like you, looking back, why didn't I start doing what I'm doing now 25 years ago?
Now, there wasn't so much of a market for it. I think radio as an industry was really, really paranoid in the 60s and 70s, and they just wouldn't give people the latitude to be themselves. And today, they thrive on characters. And the people who make the big money are
the characters.
They're really flamboyant. And, of course, they get fired often, too, because in the course of trying to be entertaining and cutting edge and press the envelope and all of that, they step over the line pretty often.
I have a friend, I won't mention his name because some of you may know him, who has just gone through contract negotiations, and he is absolutely, he's broke. He said, I haven't paid my apartment rent in 2 months. There's no food in my house. And the next day I called him back, and he's doubled his salary.
Yeah.
They came through. They took him 2 months. If they'd known how broke he was, they wouldn't have done it. I also know a guy who's been fired from Clear Channel 3 times.
There you go.
So if there's just no money in it, guys.
No.
Out there, those of you who are thinking about radio, there's just, you know.
It's a very, very risky business. And I think it's kind of exciting, but I do crave stability, I will have to admit. I really.
Yeah.
or like that. And part of that is a fear thing. If you're afraid of being able to succeed, you know, stability is more important to you. And I have to admit, I feel that way.
But I don't think that's you can't blame that on being blind. A lot of people feel that way. I mean,
I know that. That's absolutely right.
A lot of people feel. I'll take the sure thing every time over something. I always have. You know, when I when I worked, I did. I worked all I could, all they would let me work. I played every job I could find. I worked every minute that I was awake. I worked because I was afraid if I quit, the rats will catch me. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. That's going to keep you running is what that can do. But I think the only relationship between that and blindness is that any time you have to go to somebody and try to get them to let you do something for them,
yeah,
you got to deal with the blindness issue.
Always.
And you got to deal with their beliefs about blindness, and you got to deal with the practical issues about how am I going to function in their environment where I can't define that environment. And that gets old.
Well, you'd think it would be better now with computers because all businesses are so computer-driven, and while the playing field's not level, we're certainly, you know, the computer's the best thing that ever happened to blind people.
Yeah, that's true as long as the applications that they use are accessible to you.
Yep.
In many cases, there are several choices as to how to do it, and if you could choose, you'd choose an application that would work for you.
Yeah.
They choose clicky, touch-screeny, visually-oriented things that may not be, and they won't let you use your choice. A lot of people who are into the recording and production thing are finding that a lot, that the sighted people who drive the environment choose the applications.
All right, we've got you through college with your degree in electrical engineering. Let's take a short break and come back and tell the story of how you got your first job. Hang on, be back. More Blind Like Me in just a minute.
Hi, my name's Donna, and for the past 5 years, I've lived up here in the cold country, Rochester, Minnesota. I'd love to move
Love
to a warmer
is
place,
Blind,
but, you know,
the audio magazine
you know
for singles.
To find. Anyway, I'm around 32 years old, give or take a couple of years, and never been married. Oh, come close once or twice, but things just didn't work out.
If you'd like more information about this exciting new magazine, phone toll-free 1-877-222-0679. That's 1-877-222-0679. Or you can receive the same information as an email. Our address is loveisblind, all one word, at blindlikeme.com. That's loveisblind at blindlikeme.com.
Our guest is Jim Snowbarger, and we have him through college with a degree in electrical engineering, and this was done in the 70s, so it was done with Braille. Much Braille, much readers, hiring readers or finding readers to read to you. RFB&D, I guess, was around then to provide books for you in some cases. Degree in electrical engineering, and you were sending out applications and doing middays on somebody's radio station.
Yep, and somebody called me from the rehab agency and said, what are you doing? And I said eating lunch, which was true, and that was Ken Jernigan, and he wasn't impressed with that answer.
A humor,
That humor didn't appeal to him at all.
All right,
but he hired me into rehab, and I did that for a couple of years, and I learned to discipline myself a little more in that environment. I learned to present myself a little better. It was a good experience. I grew up a bit during those 2 years. But I knew I wanted to be in the field I had been educated for. And I was going to make a lot more money. I was going to be off doing what I really wanted to do. And so I started applying. And I think
affirmative action had just started, and the government was applying pressure on government contractors to find qualified handicapped people for this and that. And, and I benefited from that, and I ended up applying this at what was Collins Radio at the time. And they said, fine, we're looking for one like you, and if you can function at all, we'll probably hire you. Well, I didn't know any of that. I thought that they wanted me to be really good, you know? So
now, Collins Radio made ham gear. They made broadcast transmitters, broadcast equipment, and not only transmitters, but you could buy a whole radio station from Collins, boards and everything from Collins. So what else did they do? What else did Collins
do? The part that I was mixed in with was military contracting, navigation systems, flight control systems, that sort of thing. But I went there. I went there to interview, and I thought, it's kind of funny, I had actually built a couple of circuit boards myself, where I had actually drawn the circuit on the board and etched the board and soldered the transistors in, and there were four transistors on this board. It was a microphone preamplifier. The thing worked, and I was terribly proud of it. And I thought, well, I want to show them that I'm a hands-on kind of guy who can really do stuff.
So you took it with you?
I took it. Now, the fact is, it really wasn't very well done. The soldering was pretty bad, as such things go. And it was very, very dead simple compared to the things that they did. But I think they were impressed with the fact that I was willing to really get in there and do stuff. That seemed to kind of change the interview, that I didn't care if I really wasn't doing the best job possible. I was just going to go ahead and do it anyway.
Now, is this you told the story one time about some place that you went to work where they said, well, we'll try this and see if it works, and if it does, you got a job. If it doesn't, you're out.
Oh, that's right, and that was another part of that. They hired me and told me that they were hiring me for less than they would pay somebody else because they didn't know whether it was going to work out.
Yeah.
Now, I could have been offended by that, but to be honest with you, I looked at that as a foot in the door, and I figured, well, that's fine once I get in here. And then I'll be able to show them what I can do. I just need to get in.
Which is the attitude you should have, but at your age, it's amazing that you had that attitude.
Yeah, because it was a little bit of an insult.
Sure.
But I think that's true for anybody, you know, when you're trying to get a job. It doesn't have to please you. It doesn't have to be something you're proud of. You need to get in the door. You need to start building a record that you can then refer back to.
Yeah.
So whatever they'll let you do, I say do it.
Really?
Yeah.
If it's a field you want to be in and somebody will let you do it, go for it.
Yeah, and then build on that. But you need that first step. So you get offered a job you don't really like. It doesn't sound like you'd be very proud of, but there's nothing else. I say take it. And a lot of life, success in life to me is not so much what you did, but what you did with what you had.
Sure it is.
And so take that little thing and succeed with that little thing and then use that as the stepping stone for the next thing.
You know, they're not going to make you the president of RCA tomorrow.
That's
not
right.
They're not going to put me on afternoons at Kilt tomorrow because
nope.
I ain't packing the goods to go there. But they might hire me to do middays at some little dumpy radio station in Texas City, which is what they did.
Right.
And I was just thrilled out of my mind to get it. So, Collins, and there you were with you. I can just see you with your little circuit board. And you showed it to them, and they said, well, we'll hire you and see how it works. So Collins Radio was where then?
That was in Cedar Rapids.
Okay.
I think that's where it started, in fact. I lived there for, three or four years when I decided I wanted to move around the country a little bit and see what other companies were like. So I made a change, and I worked for Northern Telecom in Dallas for a while. And
you applied for that job in Dallas and got it?
Yep.
On the strength of what you'd done at Collins?
Yes, right.
And what did they make? What did they have you doing?
Oh, that was telecommunications equipment, computer programming, basically. I'd gotten pretty heavily into software as opposed to electronics at Collins. And so that was a software job, and we were dealing with pulling the switching equipment for billing information and communicating it around the country and that kind of stuff. We were writing the software that does that. And I think when I applied for Northern Telecom, I didn't tell them I was blind. They had a resume that didn't even show that. And they called me, and we had a great conversation. And, boy, they were excited about that conversation, and they still didn't know.
You still hadn't told them you couldn't see.
That's right.
Whoa, I love it.
Well, because everything that they had learned from me so far, I could actually deliver to them. So, you know, it was real. I just wasn't telling them everything. But I didn't tell them everything because I knew they would mishandle the information.
True.
So I walked, so then they invited me in for an interview, and they still didn't know.
They flew you down from Cedar Rapids to Dallas?
Yep.
Okay.
And I showed up, and here I am. Now they know.
You had a cane or a dog or what?
That's right.
That is a wonderful, wonderful story. So you've found their building, and you walked in, and you asked, where can I find Mr. So-and-so? And
well, they don't let you wander around on your own anyway. You show up in the lobby and tell them who you are and ask for a certain contact person, and that person comes out. And that's true no matter sighted or not.
Comes to the lobby. So he walked in and said, you're Jim Snowbarger?
Yep.
And you said, yes, sir. Yes, sir, I am. You held your hand out. What did he say?
He didn't say anything unusual. We just went about the interview. He didn't say, oh, my goodness, or anything. I'm sure he's thinking things. But at some point later in the day, of course, we got down to talking frankly about that. And I encouraged him at that point to talk about their concerns about the fact that I was blind and how I would function in that environment.
But he never, on his own, brought it up.
Right.
That's wonderful.
I wanted him to bring it up, of course.
Well, then they eventually, yes.
They were thinking about it, so I drew it out as we talked in the interview.
Well, yeah, but
I wanted to address all their concerns right there.
Okay, but you'd been around this guy a while before you brought it up.
Yeah,
and they
knew what was behind the blindness. You know, they knew that there was a real person with a real mind here. And
yeah, who could really do
the mind?
Who could really do what they wanted done?
They didn't need a football player or a truck driver. They needed a mind.
Yeah.
And so I had one, and they knew that. Now we can get down to the practicality of how will you find the bathroom and how will you read this and that.
Okay.
So
you spent the day with this guy, and he hired you.
Yeah.
And he moved you to Dallas, and now you were living in Texas.
Yep.
I'll be darned. Had you married by then, or
you had
married your lady that you're with now?
No,
by then.
But I was married. I'd been married for 3 or 4 or 5 years, I guess.
Oh.
When that happened.
And she went with you to Dallas.
Yeah.
A sighted lady.
Yeah. They're handy.
They are handy. They can drive the cars. The greatest thing they can do is drive that car.
Read that stuff.
We're not knocking blind women. We love them too, but sighted women
are
handy.
They've got their own merits.
So you moved to Dallas, stayed with these folks how long?
I was there for, I think, 3 years, and then things happened in life, and I needed to get back to Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to get here to be near some other people, and so that's all another story. But so I fished around up here, and I found this company, and I've been with them ever since, although I lived in Texas again for these people for a couple of years in the mid-'80s.
Oh, really?
But I like Iowa. I'm from here, and at the time, Iowa was a simple, very clean, mostly white area, and I really prefer to live among white folks. I'm white, and white culture and white ways are my ways, and I'm not knocking anybody else, but that's my preference, and mm-hmm. So I want to get back here. And, of course, things changed even here over the course of decades.
You mean we're a little too Hispanic for you?
And very Hispanic and very black.
Yeah.
And that does affect the nature of the culture and the kinds of things that
are
done.
Sure it does.
I saw in Texas what the country was going to become, and I wanted to get back to what little was left of what I liked most.
And so back to Iowa you came.
Yeah.
And you worked in, where did you live in Texas for this company?
In Austin.
In Austin. So you've
yeah.
lived in Dallas and Austin,
yeah.
both in Texas.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that. And then, so you moved back to Iowa and went to work for the people that you're working for now.
Right. And I've been here ever since. So I've been with this company 20 years. And that's got a nice benefit. You know, these people know me well. They understand me pretty well. They know what I can bring to their table, but they know that I have certain limitations, that there are things that are harder for me
mm-hmm.
than other people, and they don't have any problem working around that, because they know how to capitalize on what I can bring to the table.
Rather than worrying about what you can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a sense of loyalty, I think, there between us after all this time.
Now, you're computer programming that you do, did you go anywhere to learn that, or did you just sort of figure that out on your own?
Well, I had a couple of courses in college, but I didn't really intend to do programming, so by the time I left college, I knew very little about it. When I got to Rockwell, all of the circuits were on paper, and I couldn't follow that. So, but I did, the rehab agency did buy me an old Braille terminal, and so I could do software. So that's just, we needed software people, and I was available. I was a new kid on the block, and I could do something with it. So I just dug in and started learning on the job. So the short answer is everything I know about computers, I've learned.
Taught yourself.
Yeah.
And everything you know about music, you taught yourself.
Yeah.
And
about everything. I was never one for being instructed. I was one for reaching out and putting my hands on it and finding mm-hmm. out. Myself. I've always been like that. I don't know why that is, but I've found that when I do that, I learn a lot about the deeper nature of things, whereas when people teach me stuff, I sort of learn what they learn and what they feed me, and I don't go much farther. I like to really dig in and find what's under the surface, because then I understand things so much better, and I know the limitations, I know what limitations are not there. I know how to bend yeah. things to my needs, I guess, when I understand better.
Now, you mentioned the other day that you are no longer, you have dropped out of the public eye. You're not doing anything for any internet radio service. You're not doing any radio. You're not playing any music anymore. You're not really participating in any blindness organizations, period. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. There's one outfit called the Republic Broadcasting Network. I do some production for RBNLive.com, but I'm a voiceover on their station. But
uh-huh.
that's just kind of on an as-needed basis. I pretty much am living a private life, quiet, and it feels really good after that. I don't know. Something happened to me, and I just wanted something different. I wanted a quieter, more settled existence, and that's what I have. I'm really satisfied with that, really gratified by it. I don't know. There's a freedom now that I have that I didn't have when I was trying to do the snowman shows and all of that, trying to push technology to do what it could sort of do and not quite. And
when I first started listening back in the late 90s to ACB radio or early of this decade, you were on once a week was it 30 minutes or an hour? It's an hour.
It was 30.
30 minutes.
Yeah.
And you had a couple of characters that you did, and it was basically a little comedy, half hour. Are those all archived somewhere, aren't they? Are they?
Yeah, that was the Snowman Radio broadcast, and they, again, if you go to snowmanradio.com, you can find your way to those archives. All the shows are on my FTP site. But that show started because the guys, Dennis Nelson and Mitch Green, who did Livestream America, just started that, and they needed some content. They really needed something, and I
yeah.
just did it as filler. The show was only intended as just baloney, just filler, just wasting time. And I said that often, but it was true. That's all it was really supposed to be.
But it was very, very, if you have that type of sense of humor, I found it hilarious. I loved it. I recorded it every week and listened to it twice. I just thought it was very funny.
Thank you.
Was my first attraction to you, or the first I heard you. And how many of those are there? Do you have any idea?
There are 81.
Really?
Kind of an inauspicious, weird number.
So 40 hours.
One day I got fed up and said, I'm not doing this anymore. But
yeah.
It really took a lot of effort to do that. The thing I was trying to achieve could have been so easy to do if you had another person with you who thought like you did.
Yes.
And who could talk with you and interact very dynamically in a way that most co-hosts don't. You know,
in other words, co-hosts compete. If I had done the hefty genitals voice, we would have been much easier, right?
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Oh, my God. I could have done that right.
I could have done it without the SPX.
Yeah.
Probably not. Anyway, they're very funny. If you want to hear them, you think you would enjoy them, give us the address.
Yeah, it's Snowman Radio, SNOWMANRADIO.com. And you'll find the FTP address there and how to get to it. I was looking for people talking to, and I'm talking to myself. I'm being all these different characters.
Yeah.
And so that took all Saturday to do that. And every Saturday I would spend all day in the studio to produce this half-hour thing to make it sound as natural as I wanted it to sound. And I don't know. I don't really think I quite got there, but I got pretty close.
I think you got there.
Phil Henry can do better than I can, and he does it live, but I think he's on steroids.
I think you got there. I think you're short-selling yourself. You got there. I was just blown away by them. I was a big Bob and Ray fan years ago, and obviously you were too. And
sure.
Jonathan Winters, I'm sure you've got some Jonathan Winters.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of humor, and if you think you would enjoy that, I don't see why you wouldn't go listen to those.
It's dry humor, but it's not nasty.
Not at all.
You know, I always wanted to keep that show slightly above the tawdry level. There was a nice old lady who wrote me early on in that show and told me how much she enjoyed that. And I always remembered her and always thought of her when I did those and thought, how can I make this funny without being tawdry? How can I make this funny, but she'll still enjoy it?
Yeah, if you wanted to gain, I told this, we're almost out of time. Let me tell you this. I told this guy was doing a little morning show, and I said, you know, if you want attention, just say the F word once an hour, and everybody in town will turn over there to hear you say it. But that's not funny. That's not humor.
I agree. I don't think I ever used it.
You never did. You never did. Sir, we are completely out of time. Yeah, our aim is to find blind people who are dealing with blindness, and you certainly are.
Thank you, sir.
And I thank you for being a part of our little show.
My pleasure.
Oh, excuse me. Hello there. That Snowbarger. What a guy. What an interesting character he is. What an interesting fellow. Go and listen to his radio stuff. We're looking for two people. One is a lady named Lynn Schneider, who I think lives in Wilmington, Delaware. If she happens to be listening, I would love to talk to her. The other guy is Nick, that used to come on ACB radio late at night with a snowman. He was a young fellow then. This has been 6 or 8 years ago, so he's probably 20-something now. I can't pronounce Nick's last name, or I would. I think he lived in New York City last time. Time I heard of him. But Nick, if you're listening, give us a call, and Lynn Schneider also. I'm Phil Parr, and we'll do this again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.